Hello, my name is Dave Emery, and in this segment we're going to continue with our examination of the assassination of Martin Luther King on April 4th of 1968. As in the previous five segments in this series, we're going to rely for our information on a marvelous new book, as of September of 1995. The book is entitled Orders to Kill, subtitled The Truth Behind the Murder of Martin Luther King. It's authored by William F. Pepper, a distinguished attorney and currently co-counsel for James Earl Ray, the patsy in the assassination of Martin Luther King. Orders to Kill was published in hardcover by Carroll and Graff, copyrighted 1995. In the previous segments, we have taken a look at what could be termed the two separate, though related, halves of the conspiracy to kill Martin Luther King. One was a, quote, civilian conspiracy involving the organized crime empire of Carlos Marcello, the capo mafioso for New Orleans, and an individual very influential throughout the American South and Southwest in organized crime circles, an individual whose name has cropped up in connection with the assassination of President Kennedy. Carlos Marcello appears to have used some organized crime associates, including a Memphis produce dealer named Frank Liberto, a Memphis restaurant owner named Lloyd Jowers, whose Jim's Grill restaurant was immediately adjacent to the rooming house from which James Earl Ray supposedly fired the shot that killed Martin Luther King. Also, a fellow named Raul, a gunrunner and organized crime associate of the Marcello organization, an individual whose connections also overlap with the intelligence community. Raul was apparently the handler who was trafficking James Earl Ray around, involving him in various types of gun-running operations across the Mexican-American and Canadian-American borders. That appears to have been a way of trafficking James Earl Ray around and getting him set up as the patsy to take the fall for the assassination of Martin Luther King. I would recommend to listeners who are interested in following up on this information that they get a hold of, among other programs, Radio Free America program number 8. That is a documentary about the assassination of Martin Luther King that's available from a tape duplication service that I will have more to tell you about later on in the segment. What we're going to look at in this segment is one of the many aliases that was utilized by James Earl Ray during his travels around. I guess we could say his travels with or at the direction of Raul. James Earl Ray at one point was using the alias of Eric Starvo Galt, G-A-L-T. We're going to first examine the use by James Earl Ray of this alias before we get into who the real Eric Galt was. The real Eric Galt worked with an American munitions company, had a top security clearance, a file with the National Security Agency, and also was doing operations on behalf of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group. That was the military intelligence group under whose auspices the Alpha Team 184, chosen from the 20th Special Forces Group in Birmingham, Alabama, was requisitioned, or under the direction of which that team was operating. Recall that in previous segments we've looked at the Alpha Team 184 snipers who were there as backup in case the quote civilian unquote half of the conspiracy failed to kill Martin Luther King. It appears that it did, although I hold open the possibility that there may have been yet another sniper, a military sniper who actually shot along with or perhaps in lieu of Raul. We're going to turn to Orders to Kill by William Pepper, and we're going to take a look at the alias Eric S. Galt that James Earl Ray was using while on the lam shortly after the assassination of Martin Luther King. By the way, James Earl Ray did not kill Martin Luther King. That's made only too apparent in this book. And in fact, the trafficking around of James Earl Ray, and in particular his use of the alias of Eric Starvo Galt, is more than a little interesting and, in all probability, a key to highlighting some of the interagency cooperation that was involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King. Recall that in earlier segments we took a look at the profound alarm that existed in the corridors of power in the late 1960s concerning Dr. King's opposition to the war in Vietnam. It was felt that the opposition by King to that war could lead to a fusing of the civil rights and anti-Vietnam War movements, and perhaps their coordination with elements of the Black and Brown Power movement. Certainly there were moves in that direction. It was felt by people in positions of power that this could lead to a revolution or perhaps even a civil war. That's not a viewpoint that I personally agree with. However, this is not to be judgmental. It's very important to understand that that is the viewpoint that was held in the corridors of power, and that the U.S. National Security Establishment responded to this perceived threat in much the same way that the National Security Establishment of Weimar Germany reacted to the abortive German Revolution in 1918 and 19, with assassination activity, death squad activity, and ultimately, of course, the Freikorps assassinations of Weimar Germany led to the formation of the Nazi Party and the ascension of Adolf Hitler. It is my considered opinion that something very similar to that is very likely to be the ultimate result of events that took place in the 1960s in the United States as well. Of James Earl Ray's use of the alias Eric Starvo Gault while on the lam, the author writes as follows. By the way, the following events take place in 1968. On April 10th, Mrs. John Riley, R-I-L-E-Y, in apartment 492 of the Capital Homes Housing Project in Atlanta, telephoned the local FBI field office to report a Mustang that had been left in a small parking space near her building. She described it as white, with a 1968 Alabama plate in the back and two Mexican tourist stickers on the windshield. She had heard that the police were looking for a man driving a white Mustang in connection with the killing of Dr. King. The Mustang, she reported, had been parked in that space since April 5th. A quick check showed that the car was registered in the name of Eric S. Gault, 2608 South Highland Avenue, Birmingham. The ashtray was overflowing with cigarette butts and ashes. On April 12th, the Miami FBI office issued and then immediately withdrew a statewide police bulletin calling for the location, though not the apprehension, of one Eric Starvo Gault. A handwriting comparison indicated that Gault was also the man calling himself Harvey Lohmeyer, L-O-W-M-E-Y-E-R, who bought the rifle at the Aero Marine Store in Birmingham. An analysis of fibers found in the trunk of the Mustang matched those on the pillow and sheets in room 5B of the rooming house rented by John Willard on April 4th. This was another of the Ray aliases. Continuing. From interviews with acquaintances of Gault, the FBI learned that he had attended the International School of Bartending on Sunset Boulevard in Los Angeles. Tomas Reyes Lau, L-A-U, its director, provided a photograph of the man. Money orders cashed in the Los Angeles area, found to have been bought at the Bank of America by Eric S. Gault, were made out to the Locksmithing Institute of Bloomfield, New Jersey. The records of that institute showed that Gault had been receiving lessons by mail beginning in Montreal on July 17, 1967, with the latest lesson having been sent to 113 14th Street, Atlanta. Local FBI agents descended on those premises on April 16th. Learning that Gault still had ground floor room number 2, they established physical surveillance for 24 hours. Author Gerald Frank maintained that when no one appeared, two agents acting under instruction from Kartha Deloach, the FBI's assistant director in Washington, disguised themselves as hippies and rented a room adjoining number 2 from James Garner, the landlord. The connecting door was padlocked from the other side, so, according to Frank, Deloach gave instructions to take the door off the hinges to get in. Deloach has denied this. Thus, they obtained, possibly illegally because no warrant had been issued, a variety of items from the room, including a map of Atlanta with a clear left thumbprint. Someone, apparently J. Edgar Hoover himself, suggested that the available fingerprints be compared against the prints of white men under 50 wanted by the police, the fugitive file. There were reportedly 53,000 sets of prints in this category. On April 17th, the Birmingham FBI office sought a federal fugitive warrant for Eric Starvo Gault, pursuant to an indictment charging a conspiracy to violate Dr. King's civil rights. Beginning on the morning of April 18th, the FBI specialists undertook the task of fingerprint comparison. By the next morning, the 700th card matched. It belonged to a fugitive from a Missouri penitentiary. His name was James Earl Ray. It was clear. Ray and Gault were the same man. Now, the use by James Earl Ray of this particular alias while he was on the lam is more than a little significant because, as it turns out, the real Eric Gault, who has a strong physical resemblance or a considerable physical resemblance to James Earl Ray, was an operative for U.S. intelligence in Canada, deeply involved with the munitions industry, specifically working for Union Carbide of Canada. He also was engaged in 1967 in a covert operation on behalf of the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, the same military intelligence group which was coordinating Alpha Team 184, the Special Forces team from the 20th Special Forces Group in Birmingham that was in position to kill not only Dr. Martin Luther King but also Andrew Young in the event that the, quote, civilian, unquote, snipers failed. We examined those teams and their numerous connections in earlier segments of this series taken from Orders to Kill. William Pepper writes about the real Eric S. Gault and his many connections as follows. At one point during my investigation of the involvement of the Army, a source placed a photograph in front of me and asked, quote, "Do you know who this is?" unquote. It was a full frontal headshot of Eric St. Vincent Gault, the man whose name James had assumed and used for most of the time between July 18, 1967 and April 4, 1968. I was told not to ask any questions because it had come from and was part of an NSA file. By the way, NSA, of course, the National Security Agency. Continuing. I learned that Gault, who, as we know, was the executive warehouse operator at Union Carbide's factory in Toronto, had top secret security clearance. The warehouse he ran housed an extremely top-secret munitions project funded by the CIA, the U.S. Naval Surface Weapons Center, and the Army Electronics Research and Development Command. The work involved the production and storage of, quote, proximity fuses, unquote, used in surface-to-air missiles, artillery shells, and light anti-tank weapon rockets, or LAWs. Gault had worked for Union Carbide of Canada Limited, which was 75% owned by Union Carbide Incorporated of the U.S. since the early 1980s. The company was engaged in high-security research projects controlled by the U.S. parent. Gault's top-secret security clearance was actually conducted by the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, and his last security check had been in 1961. Union Carbide's nuclear division ran the Oak Ridge National Laboratory in Oak Ridge, Tennessee. I learned that in August of 1967, shortly after the time when James assumed the Gault identity, the real Eric Gault met with Gardner's aide and that they met again in September. At that time, Gault was cooperating with another 902nd Military Intelligence Group operation that involved the theft of some of these proximity fuses and their covert delivery to Israel. I have obtained a confidential memorandum issued by the 902nd Military Intelligence Group on October 17, 1967, which confirms and discusses this operation, Project MEXPO, that's M-E-X-P-O, all in capital letters, which was defined as a, quote, military material exploitation project of the Scientific and Technical Division, or S&T, in Israel, unquote. The file and project number was 10518S-MAIN, M-A-I-N, again, all in capitals. The memo indicated that pursuant to a conference held on July 12, 1967, it was agreed that the 902nd would provide administrative support services to the project. The real Eric Gault was listed in the Toronto telephone directory in 1967-68 as Eric Gault, with no middle name or initial. And in 1967, he had begun to use the initial S, dropping his middle name, St. Vincent, entirely. When James, in July of 1967, assumed the alias Eric S. Gault, he was signing the name in the same way as the real Gault had recently adopted. The coincidence was impressive. James had somehow acquired the name of a highly placed Canadian operative of U.S. Army intelligence. Further, he began using the name on July 18, 1967, around the time the real Eric Gault was meeting with Gardner's aide. I had to finally conclude that though James likely obtained the other aliases by himself, there was little likelihood that he, on his own, had accidentally chosen the Gault identity. He was, however, as was his right, apparently determined to protect someone or some persons who he believed had tried to help him, though he almost certainly did not know who ultimately provided the alias to him. Skipping down, previously I had no doubt that James was used and manipulated, but now it was apparent that his manipulation involved not only elements of organized crime, but also a specific, senior-level, highly covert military intelligence group, the involvement of which could be traced back at least to July 18, 1967, when he began to use the Gault identity. Suddenly, Galt appeared to be a critical link, facilitating the use of James Earl Ray as a patsy by a covert part of Army intelligence and involving the 20th Special Forces Group, the FBI, and the other associated and collaborating members of the government and intelligence community involved in the assassination of Martin Luther King. I raised the connection with deep cover source Herbert. He nodded and said, quote, James Earl Ray was a dead man, unquote. The identity was not to have mattered. He was to have been blown away either in Memphis or in Africa if he made it that far. By the way, Africa was one of James Earl Ray's ultimate destinations after he fled to Great Britain. He never made it to Africa. Continuing with William F. Pepper's text. But why was Eric St. Vincent... Oh, by the way, before I begin this section, this discusses the probable reason why this particular identity of Eric S. Galt was given for James Earl Ray. It was basically to facilitate his manipulation as a patsy and to see to it that he would not be interfered with before the proper time. Continuing. But why was Eric St. Vincent Galt's identity chosen for the patsy? It finally made sense when I realized that the use of an identity with top secret clearance was a means of securing and protecting the patsy from any mistakes or problems he would encounter before he was needed. Any routine police check would come up against a protected file, and the result would be that the government agency, in this instance the NSA and the Army through the ACSI's office, could control the situation and instruct any law enforcement authorities to let the patsy go. Galt, a Canadian citizen with some physical resemblance to James, would have no need to know about the use of his name, and it was therefore unlikely that he would be told. James would also most likely not have known anything about Eric S. Galt. The next segment of Orders to Kill that we're going to examine concerns a piece of information from the book The Puzzle Palace by James Bamford, arguably the best book about the National Security Agency, a very powerful agency about which comparatively little is known and even less has been written. Apparently, the National Security Agency was actually involved with the search for James Earl Ray that he was on the lam. Bear in mind that Warren, the pseudonym for a member of the 20th Special Forces Group Alpha Team 184 that was in Memphis to kill King and Andrew Young in case the civilian marksman failed, he identified an individual photographed coming down off a wall as a former associate of his from the Special Operations Group and First Special Operations Group in Can Tho in Vietnam. Warren stated that he believed this individual was working for the NSA in 1968, all of which may go to indicate the involvement of the National Security Agency in some way with the other national security elements involved with the assassination of Martin Luther King. Of the National Security Agency's role in the search for James Earl Ray while he was on the lam, William Pepper writes as follows. The fact that the NSA had a file on Eric Galt reminded me that James Bamford, in his research for his book The Puzzle Palace, had stumbled upon a very well-kept, highly classified secret, the surreptitious involvement of the NSA in the effort to locate James after the assassination. As early as 1962, the NSA had systematically begun to include in a, quote, watch list, unquote, the names of persons and organizations who were engaged in dissent against America's Vietnam policy. In 1967, this list and its focus increased sharply. On October 20th of that year, General Yarbrough sent a, quote, top-secret comment channels only, unquote, message to NSA Director Marshall Carter, requesting that the NSA provide any available information about possible foreign communications to and influence on individuals associated with civil disturbances in the United States. By the way, of course, General William Yarbrough, the Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence at the time and under whose command organizations like the 111th and 902nd Military Intelligence Group and 20th Special Forces Group Special Team Alpha 184 were operating. Continuing, this request was apparently unprecedented. The Army began to send over page after page of the names of protesters gathered by Army intelligence units from all over the country whom they wanted surveilled. The CIA, the Secret Service, the FBI, and the DIA followed suit. The result was that this, quote, watch list, unquote, grew enormously and went far beyond its original purpose. The NSA had a vacuum cleaner approach to intelligence gathering, sucking up all telecommunications of targeted individuals into the system. The use of a targeted person's or organization's name triggered the interception and recording of the conversation, which was then subsequently analyzed. Thus, if an organization or a person was targeted, the communications of everyone in contact with them would be subject to this process. Thousands upon thousands of private communications were scooped up and scrutinized by the big ear of the government. The NSA became involved in the search for James Earl Ray in May of 1968. Attorney General Ramsey Clark and a number of Supreme Court decisions had frustrated the FBI's efforts to institute microphone and electronic surveillance of James' brothers and sisters. Eventually, an FBI internal memorandum conceded that such a measure would likely be unconstitutional, and it was dropped. Then, however, Frank Raven, R-A-V-E-N, the NSA's officer who received the watch lists from the rest of the law enforcement and intelligence community and acted upon them, received a direct order to place Ray's name, along with several aliases, on the watch list. What was unusual about this occurrence was that it was not a request from the FBI or the Justice Department, but an order that came directly from the Office of the Secretary of Defense, Clark M. Clifford, who has no recollection of issuing it. Raven said that he tried to object to the order on constitutional grounds, but was told that, quote, "you couldn't argue with it. It came from the highest level," unquote. The author then goes on to speculate about the significance of the NSA's involvement in the search for James Earl Ray, as well as the use of James Earl Ray of the Eric S. Galt alias. Again, an Army intelligence asset with an NSA file, a top secret clearance, and an individual who had a physical resemblance to James Earl Ray and who was involved in a covert operation for the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, under whose auspices the 20th Special Forces Group Alpha Team 184 was operating. Returning to the text of Orders to Kill. The NSA's involvement in the investigation of James Earl Ray has never been revealed in any official investigation. What was emerging then was the involvement of Army intelligence, more precisely the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, which was under the direct control of the Assistant Chief of Staff for Intelligence, Major General William P. Yarborough, with James from at least July of 1967, through his use of the identity of one of the 902nd's assets who had top-secret security clearance. This led to the subsequent unconstitutional involvement of the NSA to use the watch list to locate him. It appears likely that the order, which was routed through the Defense Secretary's office, found its way there from the Office of the Army Chief of Staff for Intelligence. The scope and complexity of this operation was literally mind-boggling. I needed to understand how it had all developed during that last year. There then follows a remarkably put-together chronology of not only the various elements of the, quote, civilian, unquote, conspiracy, the organized crime element of this vast conspiracy, but also the military elements, and it also relates the events that were taking place in the country at that time and the reaction of many of this country's leaders to the social unrest connected not only with the civil rights movement, but also the anti-Vietnam War movement. Concern over the course of progressive politics in this country led the powers that be in this country to conclude that the possibility of a revolution and civil war was very real, and deadly force and the full power of the national security establishment was then recruited in order to see to it that that did not happen, with altogether deadly results which have implications running right up to the present time. Recall that in this series we began taking a look at the, quote, civilian conspiracy, unquote, actually a civilian slash organized crime wing of a vast national security conspiracy that involved the organized crime organization of New Orleans capo mafioso Carlos Marcello. Marcello, in turn, was using a Memphis produce dealer and organized crime associate named Frank Liberto, as well as a Liberto gambling associate named Lloyd Jowers, who owned a restaurant very close to the rooming house from which James Earl Ray supposedly fired the fatal shot, a gun runner, and also an individual involved with the Marcello organization named Raul, appears to have been not only the individual who was trafficking around James Earl Ray, but quite possibly an individual who fired the fatal shot that actually killed Martin Luther King. Raul was known to have bragged about exactly that. We also took a look at the Army intelligence spying program that had been conducted against black American civil rights leaders over a period of decades. In the 1960s, that focused heavily on Dr. Martin Luther King. In particular, we took a look at the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, the 111th Military Intelligence Group, and the Alpha Team 184, recruited from the 20th Special Forces Group, based in Birmingham, Alabama. The professionals on that eight-man Green Beret team, all of them experienced covert ops veterans from Southeast Asia, many of them having worked for the same units, were in position in Memphis, Tennessee, to kill not only Martin Luther King, but also Andrew Young, later U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations, in the event that the, quote, civilian, unquote, conspiracy backfired. We took a look at documentation concerning that, and the information provided by two individuals referred to by William Pepper as Warren and Murphy, actual members of Alpha Team 184, as well as two people who were doing photographic work for Alpha Team 184, whom Pepper terms Norton and Reynolds. We also took a look at information about an earlier attempt to kill Martin Luther King, also involving 20th Special Forces Group professionals. This killing was to have taken place at the famous Selma, Alabama Civil Rights March, which Dr. King led. However, he took an unexpected turn that saved his life, at least for a period of 3 years. We also took a look at the presence on both the Selma and Memphis 20th SFG teams of a fellow named John D. Hill, who later was murdered under strained circumstances, supposedly by his wife, but there appear to be several severe problems with that analysis. We took a look at the involvement of Jack Youngblood, a mysterious veteran intelligence operative, with some of the people later involved with the 20th Special Forces Group Alpha Team 184. Youngblood had apparently been involved with some of these same individuals and also involved in covert operations in Southeast Asia. We took a look at Merrill McCullough, a black operative for the, actually I should say an African-American, because black ops are is a designation referring to covert operations. Merrill McCullough, a black American, shall we say, was spying on Dr. King in Memphis on 4-4-68. He was operating for the 111th Military Intelligence Group and later was checking Dr. King's vital signs after King was killed. We also took a look at the real Eric Galt, one of the many identities used by James Earl Ray while he was on the lam. The real Eric Galt was an Army intelligence asset with a top secret clearance and NSA file and involved with covert operations for the 902nd Military Intelligence Group, under whose auspices the Alpha Team 184 was operating. I have made reference to a tape duplication service that has on file, on a permanent basis, the archive shows that I've referred to. The archive shows are a form of radio documentary that I've put together over the years in which the printed sources upon which the lines of argument presented are based are read on the air, literally extracted on the air, so that listeners can tape the programs and then use the resulting tapes as an audio study resource. The tape duplication service stocking those tapes is Archives on Audio. Their address is P.O. Box 170023, Box 17-0023. That is in San Francisco, California, 94117, 94117-0023. The phone number is area code 415-346-1840. There's also a 20-page catalog which lists all of the archive shows, gives a synoptic description of each, and cross-references the programs with other broadcasts containing similar or related material. Again, neither myself nor the station makes money out of this arrangement. This is set up FYI. Individuals searching for books in this field can avail themselves of Antifa Book Service. They're located at 945 Taraval Street, T-A-R-A-V-A-L Street, in San Francisco, number 117. The zip code is 94116. Again, Antifa Book Service, A-N-T-I-F-A, 945 Taravelle Street, number 117, San Francisco, California, 94116. And as is the case with Archives on Audio, neither myself nor this station makes money out of this arrangement. This concludes this particular segment. My name is Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.